Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Ink Drop. I am your adorable host, Matthew McGevna. And if you're here listening, it's probably because you've been banned from Twitter. At this rate, I think I might start investing in companies that make ham radios. Or Morse code. Take your chances with the FCC. Because, you know, you're going to have to serve somebody. There will always be a boss. Dadgummit. It's funny how interconnected we are when you think about it. Try to unplug yourself from all mechanisms of control. It's almost impossible. There's hardly a scenario where you can plan out something you'd like to do for a living or to support yourself, where if you piss off the wrong person, the one guy gets his nose out of joint and your whole house of cards comes crumbling down. You literally have to unplug entirely. Go get a cabin in the woods. Write op-eds that might get published in newspapers, but you don't need them to be published in order to eat. Live alone in your cabin. It's been done before. You know. The Unabomber. Not a lot of other examples are there out there. Yeah. Anywho, my guest this week, speaking of newspapers, is a radio host and former print journalist, Gianna Volpe. She hosts The Heart of the East End on WLIW 88.3 FM out here on the East End of Long Island. Gianna plays an eclectic mix of music from all decades and interviews folks from all walks of life. She and I actually came to meet several years ago when I was out on the road promoting Long Island Noir, which is an anthology of short stories published by Akashic Books. They published it in 2012, I believe. If you don't have a copy of Long Island Noir, I'll link to it in the show notes. Actually, a lot of really good stories in that series. Anyway, we became fast friends. She was a Cub reporter, and I was doing a story on the venue I was reading at. I was reading from my story at a venue she was doing a story on. She was featuring it. We finally got to sit down. It took a little while. We finally got to sit down and talk through Zoom, and here's our conversation. So I'll stop talking and get out of here before I get in further trouble. Please welcome Gianna Volpe.
So coronavirus isn't slowing you down. I see you on Facebook Live once and every now and then, and I see that you got like the whole Jesse James train robber. With your bandana, you look like Jesse James with the bandana over your face. It doesn't seem like it slowed you down at all.
It did slow me down. Yeah. So much of the show that I've built is about the community and being with everyone. So it didn't slow me down so much as, you know, we did the pandemic pivot. Mm-hmm. It was tough not transitioning to not having people in the studio. But what I decided was, okay, why not just, before the pandemic had hit, I was pushing my guests to come into the studio that I could, see them in person. And I was trying to stay away from phone interviews. So I basically used it as an opportunity to build that skill and really dive headfirst into getting a good interview just without seeing the person. Harry Gross style, as it were.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between sitting in the room with somebody across from someone and even doing this so much. Do you notice that there's like a difference?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think that I don't have as much Zoom fatigue as other people do, because I never stopped. There was never any lull for me, because as soon as March came about and the studio was locked down, that didn't slow down how much I was talking to people. And I never, you know, being essential, all that meant was through the pandemic, while everyone was cocooning, staying home, I was continuing to drive an hour to the studio every morning and then just reporting the numbers and talking about what was going on. Mm-hmm. So there was never really room to breathe. And on top of it, the company was acquired at that time and we moved studios. And it's really kind of been, it's been nonstop, change all the time, new systems, new studio, new ways of being. Wow. And really, I haven't done much of what everyone is really doing, podcasting and video in and vlogging, because that's what I had been doing. Right. And now I was, it was like all just full steam ahead with a whole bunch of other things that I really hadn't done as much before.
So is the studio doing like bare bones kind of staff? Like I've heard other radio stations will sometimes like the back staff is home or the producers are remote and they're connecting through IBF or IFB or through other means. But are you, do you have your whole crew with you when you're in the, when you're in the studio now?
Well, so very bare bones. I mean, for me, I've been pretty strongly, you know, producing the show as well as running the board and doing the music, doing the playlist, booking the guests, doing the promo, kind of doing everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, our techs have been home, definitely doing tech stuff as well. But yes, very bare bones. Really no, you know, no contact with anyone else. But, you know, even the new studio, when March came around, I had asked that there be separation between me and the morning person. So we weren't in the building at the same time. And now that we're in the new studio, he has his own studio. So we really don't have any really much interaction at all.
Yeah, yeah. I'm too scared to have anyone in front of me. I'm wildly out of shape. If I get this thing, I'm a goner, you know?
I really believe that I had it last January.
Oh, really? What happened?
Well, I very rarely get sick. I'm a very hard worker. And I you know, if I get any sense that I'm about to be sick, I would emergency it out of existence because yeah. I can't afford to get sick.
Yeah.
All I can say is last January, I found myself in front of a doctor twice in a single month.
Mm.
First time, they had given me an antibiotic. And the second time, I remember I got off the air. I didn't feel sick. Right. I just felt something. I felt like I was going to be getting sick. I drove an hour home. I called the tech and I said, listen, I'm going to sleep right now. I'm not coming to work tomorrow. Mm. I slept for 18 hours straight.
Whoa.
And I woke up with the biggest glands ever. My mother, my whole life has been telling me, gee, you got to goggle with salt water. Sick. Yeah. This was first time that I gargled with salt water and I felt like it was God, you know, and I went, to the walk-in clinic and I went in and I said, hi, I feel like the tops of my lungs are not inflating ? You know, they tested me. They said, it's not the flu. It's not strep. I had certainly been hearing, being a journalist, I had been hearing about people getting sick and this strange stuff. I'd been listening to NPR News. I knew about COVID-19. And I really was very annoyed when February 26th rolled around and I heard the messaging from the Fed finally, and when I found out that this had been in the intelligence reports through January, I was pissed off.
Sure.
Because frankly, I'm in a job where the community is coming in every day. I would have liked a heads up. I would have liked to know what was going on. I would have liked to, you know, like, it's not something that you can stick your head in the sand about if you understand public health, which we all have gotten quite a bit of a crash course. For me personally, I was raised by a public health official who penned pandemic response annexes. Wow. So, I mean, my father raised me to be preparing for a situation like this, or frankly, worse.
Wow.
And really, it's I say worse, but I'm talking about from the numbers.
Right.
But the situations that are worse, the perspective has changed as far as how to prepare for such a thing, because apparently we couldn't handle something that was not as bad as say a 20% or more mortality rate.
Right. Yeah. The and so much for journalists being in cahoots with politicians, because you're a journalist, you think you'd be the first one to know this stuff.
I feel like as a journalist, I knew in January there is something going on.
Yeah.
Just from the anecdotal, what I'd been hearing from the people.
Right, right.
And what I really thought about was, my gosh, how mishandled from every aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember watching the news one day and seeing, for example, like Greenport Harbor Brewery. I feel like they kind of were unfairly villainized, and not even by any fault of their own. It was the way that things were rolling out. And
can you explain that a little? What happened with Greenport Harbor Brewery? I read about it, but what was the?
Well, it was more of just they were victim of circumstance.
Yeah.
So you talk about the way that these things were rolling out, and you talk about the fact that COVID-19 had been, for lack of this is a sensationalistic word, but festering in the community for much longer than we really were dealing with it as a journalistic community, as, you know, in any real way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I remember watching the news one night and the volume's off, and I see the flash of the image of the coronavirus, which we're all very familiar with that, that graphic.
Yeah, it looks like a bag of catnip.
And then the Greenport Harbor Brewery bottling line. And I'm like, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
Like, there's coronavirus in the beer. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not helping anyone. Yeah. And I really felt, I had Greg Ling on my show recently because, I really wanted to ask him, you know, he was basically dubbed patient zero and made this poster child, but yet, I think that really belies the reality of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really the truth of the fact of the matter is that by that time, it was already a dangerous situation. It had already been in the community.
Yeah, there's a lot of finger pointing going around, seems like, with this, you know, like, you know, finger point is starting in China, then it moved over to Europe, and then it's in New York, and then this,
And that ultimately is unhelpful.
Right.
What was important and what I tried to make sure that I was doing every morning was just repeatedly telling people how they could stay safe and keep one another safe.
Right.
And sure that people understood that this is not a joke. It's real, you know, and it's about, you know, this is how you know, wash your hands. Mm-hmm. Here's how you make hand sanitizer. Cause at the time the chain of supply, the supply chain had kind of broken down.
Right.
People were, you know, had hoarded their way into, you know, there was panic mm-hmm. all over. So it was like, stay calm, stay informed, stay home.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was like, stay apart as we're finding out more and more about how this was spreading.
Right.
Yeah. Just try.
Yeah. The, you know, I remember like sort of like going into the supermarket like the week before. I mean, for me, from my point of view with it was the schools. I was paying attention to what Mayor de Blasio was doing because I'm a New York City school teacher. So I was, you know, we were sort of pins and needles waiting for him to tell us what's going on. And I'm in the supermarket locally and I'm like walking around and I'm like, and there's a woman next to me. And she's like, my husband sent me here. I don't know what to get. Like, I don't know what we're supposed to be scrambling for. And we're all just sort of looking at each other and grabbing random stuff off the aisles, like baked beans. And like, well, where are we going? Are we trekking through the woods?
like I said, a little bit about my father.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, my father very much raised me with this survivalist mentality and taught me a lot of real practical stuff. You know, here's how to shoot a gun. Here's how, to keep safe in the woods and building fire, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I had been on this journey toward like hoarder recovery, basically, for years, and was what I had termed 85% dehortified is how where I was in my journey when this hit. So I forced myself not to hoard at all.
Right.
And I'll tell you the weird thing about it is I have pretty good intuition. It goes with the field. The week before I had been in CVS or something, and I was looking at the big thing of toilet paper, and I live alone. And I remember I was like, I'm going to get the big thing of toilet paper.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm good for the winter.
Right.
And I'll tell you, for one reason, I'm just finishing that big thing of toilet paper right now.
Wow. Congratulations.
So it's really like.
It was gone. The toilet paper was gone by the time I got there. And from what I had heard, like an hour before I got there, it was like Black Friday for toilet paper, you know, like people just shoving each other out of the way, you know, that was the.
And like, what even is Black Friday anymore? You know?
Yeah, that's.
And I'll tell you something, you know, say what you will. I mean, 2020 has been this total right turn into the digital world that we've been needing to make. Especially as journalists, this is something that, you know, the newspapers have been kind of like, you know, figuring it out. And it's like now everyone is sort of scrambling and figuring things out. And it's something that journalists have been dealing with for a long time, which is the, you know, everyone's a journalist now.
Yeah.
Everyone's also a photographer. Everyone is everything. Everyone is a marketer.
Sure.
You know, everyone is a brand. And I'll say, you know, so many people being lost, so many lives, homes, jobs. I call it the snowball shake of a year. People are, you know, they'll land in different places than they were. But you talk about right now is like the holiday season.
Yeah.
when has that been more in the forefront and more understood and appreciated? You know, for me, I've had a near-death experience, and I learned at that time that there is nothing in this world that that matters more than breath in your lungs.
Right.
You know, and I'm pretty sure that the masses are kind of on board with that now.
Can you talk about that, your near-death experience, or you don't like to?
No, it's all right. What do I say about it? I will say that, so it was a near-death car wreck, and it was 11 Novembers ago in the desert of New Mexico. Mm. And I will say that surviving that, and it gave me an access to what veterans go through when they come home from war, post-traumatic stress, what that's all about. The idea of really, it's like a club that no one wants to join.
Right.
You know, and you don't really get it until you experience it. And something that I used to say was, aside from the accident, everything else has been positive. Because if you come that close to dying, you now know that how important gratitude is. And I think that we all kind of get that now.
Dostoevsky talked about that, because he faced a firing squad in his life, and he got like a reprieval, like moments before he was supposed to be shot. And he talked about what that was like in the perspective. And they actually said his life flashed forward, not back. Like many people think they would think back to their lives, but
interesting.
He's actually thinking forward to the life that he had yet to live.
I had one of those in June. I can't talk about that. Okay. But I did have a flash forward moment.
Hmm.
And it makes me curious about Dostoevsky's, the circumstances of that.
Right.
The circumstances behind the reprieval. Like, yeah. why he faced the firing squad, why he was excused from it, yeah. And whether or not there was any sort of not corroboration, but do you know what I'm getting
yeah.
at?
Yeah, well, it sounded like what I knew about him, it was for political dissidents, but from what I knew about it is I think he had a political connection. I think his father was a military, ex-military or something like that. And so they managed to pull some strings to get him off the line, get him off the firing line, which is just amazing, you know,
And it was for speaking against
speaking against the Tsar, and again
interesting.
It's pretty fascinating, and people like that, people will say a lot of them when they read that, if anyone's been through a traumatic experience like that, a lot of times they can attest to that idea that there's like a, you know, that there's a weird moment, you know, if you're fortunate enough to feel like it's coming, I guess, then you get the sense to think about it. You know, most people who have that, they don't even realize what's happening until it's about to happen. Meaning there are some people who I've spoken to who've had these like really close calls where they, like for example, someone I know was in like a passenger Cessna and there was a crash and it crashed. But, you know, but it was like an emergency crash. So he had no idea whether he'd survive. So we had some time to think, you know, as opposed to somebody who might just be driving on the intersection. Yeah. And just get sideswiped and sideblinded.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. When he was sitting there thinking, he said he doesn't really remember exactly what he was thinking, but something resonated with him when I told him about Dostoevsky. He's like, you know, I think I went through something similar in my head in those moments as the plane was approaching the ground.
Yeah. For me, those situations, the thing that's interesting is that, you know, I've been in a few, or at least even just witnessed, there was a time when I watched a drunk driver hit a band van. The band was packing up their stuff after a show, And I was either tending bar or doing security that night. Mm-hmm. And I was outside and watching the, and I watched the drunk driver hit the van. And so, and I remember this situation being like that as well. When situations like this happen, time seems to slow down for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was able to get the license plate correctly and said it over and over in my head until a police officer arrived. And then I heard someone else giving the wrong license plate number. And that's when I went over and said, no, this is the correct license plate.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've had situations like that and time seems to slow down, but I was more interested about, I'm going to have to look that up with Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
The flash forward thing.
But yeah, he did. No, and that part I'm pretty sure of. But like why he was facing the firing squad, I'm a little fuzzy on.
Well, the weird interesting about it is that it's an easy way to segue back into the difficulty of doing the job of journalism in 2020. Uh-huh. Slash these last few years.
Right. Go ahead.
I mean, what do you say?
Yeah.
I forget what year it was. It must have been 2013, 2014. And I remember it was around when I was a rookie reporter. I was one of the four rookie reporters in the state for NYPA, right? And that was 2013 for my work. 12. And I remember around that time, there was some kind of poll, and it said how being a reporter was being ranked the worst job at the time.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was a tough time to be a reporter, but man, has it not gotten easier.
Right.
And been it's just been, I'm speechless about it, and that's not easy.
Yeah. Well, What are some of the challenges? Is it the financial aspect to it, or is it more about?
Sure, I mean, few jobs, right?
Yeah.
The traditional news outlets are facing fiscal challenges that are, and everyone is. It's incredibly competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Very few jobs, yes.
Yeah.
But then also, something that's been happening for years, seeing the walls crumbling between advertising and editorial.
Right.
And and then you add on top of it a political administration that is so vicious, has such a vicious attitude toward the press that they're actively, villainizing the press.
Yes. Yeah.
Describing the American press as the enemy of the people. I've always been big about semantics, rhetoric, and how words matter, how everything matters.
Mm-hmm.
What you say, how you say it. Mm-hmm. And I remember last summer, I was reading the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times three times a week before most people had woken up. I was delivering these papers because I was doing night security for very wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was delivering their Wall Street Journal and their New York Times. And then the last hour of my shift, I would be waiting for the day crew to come in and I would be reading what's going on throughout the country and the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just reading what's going on. And I'm like, uh-oh. Like, what a time to be a journalist. And there were moments personally as a journalist where I've wondered, am I in America?
Right.
Question mark.
Yeah.
That's two total WTF moments for me.
Right.
I feel like my lungs are not inflating, question mark. That was a WTF moment.
Yeah.
And then am I in America? Yeah. Question mark. Like what is this? Yeah. This summer was certainly something else.
Yeah. Because you're a local journalist, you know, right, by and large, who covers, I mean, the coronavirus is a national story, so I'm sure you're plugged into the national world. But, like, I would imagine, because I was a local journalist for a little while, too, and you can't help sometimes but get sucked into some of what's happening nationally. And so did you, like, when you're out there, acting as a reporter, acting as a journalist, even on the East End of Long Island, where you're located, right? Like, did you find that, like, you had that, like, all of a sudden you ran into a wall of people who didn't trust you? I used to run into that a lot mostly with conservatives, but with others. I would be out in the community covering a story, and it would be like, oh, you're the press? And it was like you had leprosy or something.
And painting you as someone you're not.
Right.
I just yesterday I went to and I'm very it's weird to say, but like I'm not into I'll tell you, this last 4 years in particular as an independent, which is what I am,
right,
so incredibly uncomfortable because I'm getting it from both sides.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, and it's like an independent is a closet Republican, mm-hmm. an independent is a closet you know, I was called a socialist down by the river, down at the Peconic Riverside yesterday, attending Ray Pickersgill's memorial. Mm-hmm. And it's just because, you know, of people want, they build a story about you.
Yeah.
They take little things. I call the East End. It's the high school where you live. And for me, I kind of keep, especially being who I am and whatever, I'm friendly with everyone,
right.
But nobody really knows what I'm about,
right.
Or what,
yeah.
And I'm just about my job.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and about, you know, for example, not only just my job, but starting a family and building a life. I'm sitting in my home.
Right.
I bought a home.
Yeah.
And that is because I busted my butt. I've worked for just about every publication out here.
Yeah.
Except East Hampton Star. I'm sort of saving that.
Yeah.
For some.
For retirement.
I guess that's the only thing I'll do right, because, you know, there were so many years, yeah. when I was told that I was crazy. Which I knew I was.
Yeah.
Being 20-something and living on the East End of Long Island,
right.
there was who was in my clique. It was me.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I was curious. I'm like, most the trajectory of the story that you hear from young journalists usually is you get out of journalism school and then you start out maybe in a local place, but then you're always got that one eye towards the city and
right.
It didn't seem like you went in that trajectory at all. Like you found a home out here.
Yeah, I grew up on the Palisades across the river.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go into the city all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I was right on, you know, we were right there. Mm-hmm. And I went into the city all the time. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Midwest to get my journalism degree.
Right.
And then I moved East End. And this was like this perfect fusion for me. It was like and people were like telling me, go to the city. You know, I remember I had one woman say, and it's after I lost my job at the newspaper and I was the rookie reporter, or one of the four, there were four that year.
Right.
And you know, she was like, you got to go to the city. They're never going to let you get ahead out here. Mm. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Mm. And I remember sitting on the sound with my dog. It was like midnight and we were listening to the waves like crash, you know, not really crash because there's really not really waves on the sound most of the time. But I was thinking of my contemporaries in the subway tunnels and fluorescent lights and all the crowding and the, you know, just the, and I, and like, you know, rats crawling across your feet and all the, you know, and I was thinking like, I felt like I was cheating the system.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? If I'm going to struggle, I'm going to do it with some leg room.
Right, right.
And in some way, and in every way, I'm glad. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I did that. Mm-hmm. It was not at all easy. Yeah. And I understand what people are going through right now. And all I have to say is, someone said something to me like, when you're going through hell, just keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
Going, because that's what makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, and when I think about the tough times being, you talked about being a reporter, mm-hmm. and yeah, that's gotten to a different level now. You know, like I've always felt kind of like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer of mm-hmm. the local news game.
Right.
And, you know, now I feel like, well, it's not Christmas Eve. Because I more feel like it's like I'm still not being, it's, I don't really know where we are in that. If we were to make it that story, I guess Christmas is coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
it's a level, and it's tough to say how it's going to play out.
Right.
You know, because there were times, and I'm talking this summer, mm-hmm. this summer, where I felt very specifically, and this is not like feelings. It's like I'm observing, I'm seeing the political infrastructure. I'm seeing the things people are saying, the events that are being set up, the way things are playing out. And I'm thinking, dang, if the Republicans are building the pyre to burn me on, the Democrats are leading me down to the fire.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things where it's like, how do you want things to play out and what can you really do about it? Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I could really figure out was that I didn't want to be used. I didn't want to be made into someone that I'm not. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't know how that even works. You know, it's right. Because you have to be careful. It's like every moment you have to be careful.
Yeah.
Of what you say, what you do, where you go, you know, how you respond. You want to talk about always being on? This is the future I chose.
Yeah, so. This is what you just talked about a minute ago. Like, is this still America? I mean, I'm hearing an American say that they have to watch what they say. That's terrifying. But it is right, because you're never really off the clock. This whole thing now. No. You know, that whatever you do, whatever you say and you wear is like your job goes with you. And it's so strange. We've given so much power. And as a journalist, like you're supposed to behave this way. Like the way you kind of take it is a little bit of a down the middle approach. That's kind of the way you're supposed to be. But there, I think there's two things. I don't, maybe there's multiple things that are sort of incentivizing journalists to take a political side. I don't know if it's a profit motive, is that a cynical way to look at it, or are there journalists who, I mean, I'm sure part of it has to just do with your personality, if you're more geared towards conservatism or more towards liberalism, but, you know, like, I wonder if there's, it just seems like there's a lot of cases where journalists are being told, like, they feel they're being pressured to have to take one side or the other, and then finding a way to monetize that, and that monetization of journalism, to me, seems like a big problem, or, you know, at least one of them.
It's funny because I feel like I have talked frankly and critically, you know, as a journalist should,
yes,
from a bird's eye view. Yes. And I have talked about politics more in the past couple years. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's because I so often refrain and don't get into it, yeah, that I've been feeling more heat.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like the fact that I have a very diverse audience.
Right.
I don't know if that's so much the case anymore. I don't know really. I don't know. I do know that I need to be careful. That's the only thing that I know, is that I have I have sort of seen or learned or like kind of put together things that for years I didn't understand about the way that I'm seen,
mm-hmm,
by not only friends, but not so friendlies.
Right, right.
And it's one of these situations where it's like, wow, like I thought I was nobody. Mm-hmm. And I that's a weird thing to even think about, because I'm a local journalist.
Yes. Yeah.
But things have happened in such a way where I sort of realized a little too late how much I need to tighten up and watch my ass, basically.
Yeah. And I, you know, I mean, it doesn't help things that, you know, we did do whatever you want to say, a reality television host as a president who turned this whole thing into reality TV. I mean, I don't know anybody that's been so obsessed with politics since Trump got elected. It used to be that, you know, the average person, the person would get elected president, you know, and then you watch the inauguration, and then eventually they just sort of fade out of their lives because you wake up in the morning and you have things to do. And this is one of the first presidents I've seen where it's like you wake up with them and you go to bed with them. It's insane. Like people who you have to almost choose to be apolitical and stay out of the news and stay off Twitter and everything, you know?
Which I think is sort of the, I guess, like, I don't even want to say that it's a mistake, because here's where I was when this election was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten burned by journalism, my love. Right. And it was this moment of like, you know, Simba, when he goes off,
mm-hmm,
and then he meets Timon and Pumbaa.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, when the world turns its back on you, right, you turn your back on the world.
Yeah.
So here I am, you know, I'm coming into my own as a reporter, and here, and I want nothing more than to be a full-time reporter. Mm-hmm. And here I am, I'm managing a bar in an Italian restaurant,
right,
and I'm watching the election happen on the news. Mm-hmm. And I remember it being so sensationalized,
yeah,
and like a reality TV show,
mm-hmm,
that I, you know, could not even.
Right.
And I was like, I'm checking out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm turning, and I really felt guilty about that.
Mm-hmm.
As I watched, I was like, you know, I can't turn my back. This is what it's about.
Right.
And I got on the radio. I was asked, I got called one day, and it was a guy that, you know, I used to listen to The Spot when it was my editor at the Suffolk Times when I was a cub reporter.
Right.
I listened to this show. It was the editor's report. And I remember, you know, before I really even knew Bruce Tria, the owner of that station, that he knew my work. And I knew him. I never listened to him. I actually didn't listen to his show until several years after I had been on the air. I had only listened to that one spot.
Sure. Yeah.
And I remember he called me one day, and this is years later, because I don't want to tell the story I don't want to tell the story of the editor's report, because it's tied to me losing my job at the paper. And that is not a road I want to travel down at all.
Okay.
But what I will say is that when I got offered the job,
mm-hmm.
Bruce Tria had called me and he said, "Gianna, I think your ship is leaving." And I said, "Well, that doesn't sound very good." And he said, "Well, let me put it this way. I think your ship is coming in." I was like, "Well, that sounds better to me."
Yeah. I like that analogy.
Yeah. And that's when I started the show. And it was over the years, building my radio show. I never talked politics.
Right.
But it was when President Trump was coming into office that I started to talk a little bit about what was going on, mm-hmm. and about how I saw it as a journalist. And, right. and it was, it's just what a time for the First Amendment, as if it wasn't difficult enough.
No. You're getting it from every angle. Getting it from every angle too, which is like I think that there's a lot of end arounds to the Constitution. And I think what it had to do is the fact that when the Founding Fathers created the First Amendment, their biggest problem was that the government was sort of impinging upon freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and that I don't think they ever. And everybody who was a worker, you know, like own their own little private businesses. So there was none of these conglomerate corporations. But you see that like freedom of speech is, and even freedom of the press can very much be influenced by things non-governmental. So I always laugh at these people who are just like, "Well, no one's arresting you." It's like, yeah, there's a lot of ways in which you can.
Not yet. First of all, that I say not yet.
Good point. Yeah. And second of all, you know, like there's a lot of ways in which people can be frightened into silence, can be manipulated into silence, and the government doesn't need you to do that. We're doing that to ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
and it's very simple. It's very easy. And it, especially when, we're human beings that aren't perfect.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, it is, I can't tell you what lessons that I've been faced with this year, but yeah, it's been a tough time for the First Amendment. I mean, since the Patriot Act, but then like also terrorism, especially cyber terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and the ways in which, and we're seeing it now, you know, this is something that for years, like at first, that was my biggest beef with President Obama was he didn't repeal the Patriot Act, because I'm a big First Amendment person and privacy and all that stuff.
Right.
But then as years went by, I started to realize part of why it's tough.
Yeah.
Because you look at cybersecurity, and once you start realizing, you're like, you go to government buildings and you're like, what are you running like MS-DOS over here? Like, what's going on?
Right.
And then, you know, I can be a little bit of a Gianna Stradamus, because I'll like sit here and write like I look at journals from 3-4 years ago, and I'm like, man, they better get cybersecurity in check. And then, you know, I listen to the news today and it's like, oh yeah, the DOJ, the Department of Defense, like Lockheed Martin, like these institutions are being hacked.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. How could you possible? I know. Yeah.
Well, and then you think about this president and who he was, and you think about like things like the Mueller report and why weren't they even looking at criminal things in that report? Like when you really look at things and you look at it like from an investigative reporter's standpoint, you're like, holy beep. You know, it's a lot. And then when you actually talk about it, you know, get ready.
Yeah. So then it makes me wonder, like, because I mean, you're, I would say probably considerably, you're quite a bit younger than me, but you're also, you seem, I get the feeling you had a little bit more of an old school journalism education at Mizzou, right? And I'm wondering, what are the journalists now, the 19, 20-year-old kids in journalism school being taught? Because I've heard this thing coming through the, like on social media I see, and sometimes headlines get shared on Facebook where it seems like the position now of journalists is that neutral is bad. Like you shouldn't be neutral, you know? And I wonder where you're
standing.
Yeah, I don't know.
I am absolutely an old school journalist in that respect.
Yeah.
I have taken stances and expressed more opinion. Mm-hmm. But that is because of the route of journalism that I've taken.
Mm-hmm.
The radio, producing a radio show, a news talk radio show, being a radio person, there is an element where in which there's more room, but my heart is in old school journalism with new school approach to it.
Right.
I've been very much, you know, respect for the institutional knowledge and for the people, the newsmen, as they're called,
right?
Whatever gender or identity that you have,
right.
The news, because this was traditionally, you know, a field, blah 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 blah.
Sure.
But it's things where it's like when I graduated from Mizzou. The year I graduated was the year they did away with sequences. So it used to be you picked a special, like a sequence, they called it. You were a newspaper journalist or a magazine journalist or a radio journal or a broadcast journalist or photo. Huh. The year that I graduated was the year they did away with sequences and everyone became a convergence journalist.
Yeah.
The year that I entered J school was the year they did away with the dark rooms, and it went straight to digital.
Digital, yeah.
I was the most multimedia minded of my class.
Mm-hmm.
I did the video. I loved collecting audio. I was a photojournalist.
Yeah.
But I was really like I did great in magazine because I was a creative writer first.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be like a hardcore print journalist.
Right.
I think that there is absolutely everything to be said for neutrality, and here's why. If you want to affect change, that's how you do it.
Mm.
Because nobody wants to be told what to think.
Right.
And if you want to talk about any of these political things, I remember I was listening to two guys sitting at the bar. They were talking about it was when there were all these mass shootings And I forget, there was one that had just happened, and they were saying something about how it wasn't the president's non-response or something. It wasn't the president. It was mentally ill people with access to firearms, which was the problem here.
Right.
I walked up and I just said, did you know that President Trump repealed an Obama-era law that made it more difficult for people with certain mental health issues to gain access to firearms?
Mm-hmm.
And the one said, I forget what they said, but I just said, maybe you should look it up.
Right.
And I walked away.
Yeah.
Okay. Instead of coming at them and being like, you're, you know, like,
yeah.
I walked away. I didn't say anything. And I heard 5 minutes later, the one guy looked to the other guy and say, you know, she's right.
Mm. Yeah.
And I realized that, like, this was around the time when it was just like, the camps had divided.
Right.
Everyone was just yelling toward each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this thing where it was like, it's children, you know, like there's no adults in the room. Like,
right.
You know, and for me, it's like, if you're saying towards the other side, it doesn't make you, if you go down to that level, you're not any better.
Right. Yeah, and by reporting these facts neutrally, they were able to sort of connect the dots themselves.
Correct.
Right.
There
seems to be like a lack of trust on the part of the reader, which is one of the things you learn in creative writing is like, you know, sometimes you have to trust that your reader is going to make conclusions about your characters or make conclusions about situations. And so, similarly, I think, there's a lot of people out there who just don't. I remember listening to a podcast a couple months ago where this person was in favor of like deplatforming people and like curbing what people say on the internet. And he said something along the lines of, well, what happens if somebody becomes very popular on YouTube or has a popular podcast and they say something wrong and go around and they say something that's inaccurate and now people
like the president turning people against the press.
Right.
You know, like, yeah. I mean, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you know, like it breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of the fact that this war against the press,
mm-hmm.
you know, the effects, the real effects it has had on our country's health and well-being,
right.
as a whole. You know, when the job, it's already, you don't go into this job because you want to make a living. You know, you do that,
right.
you would have gone into PR.
Yeah.
You know, these are people that sit in the meetings, that sit through like god-awful, like, you know, like, and they do it to give the people the information they need to make informed decisions to form a more perfect union. Like, there's nothing more sacred to what being an American is,
mm-hmm.
than this work.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. And it's just like, how devastating is it when you see something, a friend of mine, Josh Bickle from, well, not a friend. He was one of my professors at SU. He took a very famous photograph at the height of the pandemic when people were blocking hospitals. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Protesting.
Right.
Thinking that this is a hoax,
mm-hmm.
and people are making it up. you know, for whatever. It is just when I look at the money in misinformation and disinformation, right, and just like, and then I get upset because it's like, look, like no one, I really want the country to come together. Yeah. And of course that is how very fluffy and idealistic of me, but it's like, it's just, it's been a really tough time to be watching and hearing and seeing some of these tweets, and especially now, yeah, with what we've got on our plates, it's almost like you come to be at a loss.
Yeah. You know, and it's even if you don't think about that everybody is necessarily going to, it's never been, I think, that in a country, in a society that is large, it's never been that everybody's going to hold hands.
No.
But there was always some way in which we kind of figured out our way, like figured out some sort of middle road, some direction that we can go in that maintained kind of the principles that we all sort of were raised to believe at least had some semblance of value.
Truth to the American way.
Yeah, and my reaction to that is that how do we acquire that? We acquire that through speech. But then you look in 2020 and you see what's happening with speech on every angle, and you're just like, it's like the one, like that's the one thing that cannot fall. And journalism, I think, falls in that category, right? As an institution, it really can't afford, we're really fucked if journalism becomes this place where I'm going to get my truth from this place and you go get your truth from that place. That can't be a tenable situation.
It's tough too, because it's very one way, because it's like, you know, if it's not, you know, it's only curbing freedom of speech if it's this,
right?
But if, you know, if it's that, then like shut them up.
If I have a good reason to, you know, I have a good reason to stop your speech, you know.
but you know, it's very messy.
Because like you were saying, you don't go into journalism to be rich, and then everybody knows that. And so you do feel like a lot of people go into journalism, they go in because they want to affect change. But I guess my feeling is then there has to be a point where, sorry, go ahead.
No, but I'm just saying that, like, maybe.
Right. If it comes to you, that's the thing. Right? Like, I think that's maybe the disconnect is that, like, I was, when I got into journalism, I was kind of in that similar vein where I'm kind of like, I would love, but I wanted a story to happen that needed to be reported about that maybe would cause change.
I went into be a witness.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's, it's so funny, because I remember my first mentor, Bruce, he said, don't be your job, you know, but then I realized that I've been my job, that I am a journalist, that's who I am, and right, that I've been one my whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I look at, when you look here,
yeah,
and see, like, these are my, wait, hold on, how do I?
Journalism textbooks?
No, these are my journals.
Notebooks, wow.
So
we're looking at a whole shelf full of notebooks filled up, yeah.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, this is from, what year is this? This is the first one.
That's cool.
And I was seven.
That's great.
See, this is me.
Wow, look at that.
Standing under the rainbow, yeah, in March of 1995.
Right.
And I even wrote, I'm age seven.
Yeah.
Just in case you don't know.
We can timestamp it.
Yeah. It was right.
It's the old timestamp. That's funny. Yeah. Have you ever like gone through that sort of, see, you went to journalism school, or at least you studied journalism.
Yes.
Whereas I didn't. So my question was like, I got into journalism by accident. I was a creative writing manager, but I had a connection at News 12, and I got hired there as a freelancer for 5 years. And then I went into the Malvern. From there, I went to the Malvern West Hempstead Herald for Richener Communications. Okay. And so I guess my question was like, what was your first, did you have to go through a bad growing pain experience? My first snafu was like, I was so naive sometimes when I was approaching things. So like the year that I started at Malvern West Hempstead was an election year for the village in Malvern. And there was a trustee who was running against the incumbent, the mayor's pin. And I can't remember his name, but the woman who ran against him was Patricia Norris McDonald. She was running for mayor. And I got a phone call one day while I'm sitting at my desk saying how like, oh, this local playground got this overhaul and it got a facelift. I'm thinking it's like a feel good story, a nice story. And the woman's, I'm taking quotes from the woman. She says, well, you know, I called Trustee McDonald, Patty McDonald, and she didn't do anything about it. And then I called the mayor, and the mayor, you know, he got it ball rolling, and now here we are, and we're about to cut the ribbon and all that. And I kind of put all that in the article. And the next day, I get like a phone call from Patty McDonald, just like, you didn't know that guy, that woman was like a plant, an operative who was trying to get me to make a disparaging remark about this woman's, you know, lack of action, you know. And I was like, oh, she reamed me out, man. My hands were shaking. Cause I really, you know, I really didn't have the journalistic chops yet to be like, to smell what was cooking, you know, from this lady who tipped me off about this playground. So I was just curious if you have like can you remember like a story that you had to like correct, or you just got reamed out over, or?
I made one boo-boo. I think I mean, there's been times where I've accidentally, you know, I've spelled someone's name wrong or whatever here and there, you know, which is bad enough. And there was one time that I made a mistake. I did. Yeah. And actually in the last couple years, it was, but no, as not correction so much. I've gotten in trouble more because I'm serious.
Right, right.
If so and so says, you know, ALS is, it's like getting, which it's not, which, well, I don't know. Mm. But the quote was, ALS is, it's like a death sentence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I had the guy calling me. I didn't say that. And I said, well, I have you recorded saying, and he called my editor and made me, you know, look like X, Y, and Z. Or I remember I started out on Shelter Island, and it was an election year. And the third party candidate won the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And I remember that there was something at the debates, the Democrat, the incumbent, was lambasting the third party candidate, calling him a flip-flopper, and I believe that it was over this, you know, we were voting on, I think, changing something from 2 years to 1 year, you know, term limits.
Oh, right.
And that whole debate, and
yeah.
You know, he was calling him a flip-flopper, and then I went to this, he was the guy that had the petition.
Yeah.
That he was standing outside of the IGA on Shelter Island, getting people to sign the petition. So I like went over to his house, and I'm like a baby cub reporter.
Right.
And I'm like reading this petition.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to this guy, and he's going on and on and on, and he's telling me everything, and I'm looking at the petition, and the incumbent was the first person to sign it. So he was he was saying, I'm against this and I've been against this. Yeah. And he flip flopping, but he was the first one to sign the petition.
Right.
Now, like, I had gone back and I wrote a story. I wrote some story, and the story was like, I put that like way down in the middle somewhere.
Mm. You buried the lead.
Correct. So my editor
unburied
the lead.
Right.
And then the next thing I know, the supervisor is calling my phone.
Yikes.
at the newspaper.
Yeah.
And saying, you know, I was not wanted around those parts there, you know, like after that.
Yeah.
That I don't basically said that my editor had it in for him. And, you know, the next thing I know, I'm like photographing like the ragamuffin parade, and he's like sticking his face in my camera and being like, put this in the reporter. And I'm like, oh God.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
My editor sent me to cover the Democrats for the election. Mm-hmm. So when it came down to, you know, election night,
yeah,
I covered his party.
Right.
And no one would speak to me.
Oh, dude. Oh, man.
Nobody would speak to me. So it was one of these things where then I won my first award because I my phone is telling me it's time to go to bed soon.
Okay.
So a morning radio thing. I won my first award. It was for political coverage. I think it was like third place, but it was a piece on the absentee ballot process.
Right.
And I went to Yaphank to witness what that's like.
Yeah.
And they don't even have chairs set up for three parties to sit comfortably at the table.
Right.
Ultimately, the third party candidate lost because there were so many people that were just voting along party lines that didn't even live on the island and did not know the candidates.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, that was
the, what's the type of journalism you would never want to do? Is there any particular, like, you have no interest in?
I don't know. I guess I've kind of had my fill of the, I've had my fill of the meetings about like curbs and, you know, signs and like,
oh, like code.
Like, yeah.
Code of, oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Although it's fascinating, it is.
Yeah, it is. It can be. Yeah, sure. For me, it's celebrity journalism. I have no interest in celebrity journalism. You know?
What is that?
A bit like, you know, like when you work for like not necessarily TMZ, but like
they actually do some. Some
good reporting. So yeah, no, it's more just like those like, I guess, what do you call them, like gossip news shows. Or those reporters who have to like sit. You ever see those things on? Oh, they make me sick. Those things on television. Those press junkets where like the actor and the interviewer are sitting in a director's chair, and the movie poster is like blown up in the background. You know, and I watch those things, and I'm like, who enjoys this? You know, and it's always like some hot little blonde chickie, and she's giggling the whole time. But I wonder if she doesn't like get off the chair and be like, ugh, this is like miserable. You know, like. They're just so useless, and I don't know, like having to sit there and laugh at the celebrities' jokes and, you know, everything.
You know what? It's funny because, like, I would like to do that, but I think I'm more like, what's his name? Is it James Corden? Who's that guy? The Late Show?
Yeah, the James Corden, yeah.
Is that his name?
Yeah. That's him. Yeah, yeah, he's...
I would be like him. I would be talking to the celebrities like any, because that's what I do.
Like they were people, but, yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Exactly. Yeah, have conversations with them. I know.
But yeah. I would not want to be as a photographer. I'm not interested in being a paparazzo.
Right.
And the type of journalism that I do not want to do ever, gotcha is not my thing.
Yeah.
Now sometimes I've been criticized for being, I've had people think that I'm not tough enough. And then I've had those same people think that I'm too tough.
Right.
And really just, it's about the same thing that we were talking about before when it comes to free speech. It's about whether or not they're saying you're saying something that they want you to be saying or not.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this was fun.
Yeah, it was. Thanks. Do you want to tell us? We already did an hour. Do you realize that it's been over an hour?
You know what? Like, oh. I mean, I think it's another hour. I've got an hour to my bedtime, but we'll go till you're tired.
Yeah, I want to know about your show. Actually,
okay.
Tell me about your show. Like, what's the you replaced Bonnie Grice? So that must have been a big like holy shit moment, right? Because Bonnie Grice is a pretty. For those who may not know who she is, she's a pretty, she's an institution really on the East End of Long Island. She does a lot. She's done a lot of interviews. She's been in the business for years. So you replaced her, but I would imagine you had to kind of build your own thing. Tell us about your show.
Okay. So, right. Actually. And it's interesting because I was talking a little bit about, going on AM radio, and it was funny because I was approaching 5 years in the business doing a 1 hour news talk show and on AM radio, and things were getting tense. I had added video. I had started adding video to it, and the show was at the point, like I would have as a journalist, if someone was asking me like, I always think of I always think of restaurants. The thing I saw as a journalist with restaurants on the East End, you know, the cycle.
Right.
Well, you know, don't expand too far too fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw that mistake made so many times.
Yeah.
Or changing concepts too early, or this and that, and so if it was. It was one of these moments where it's like, I sort of wouldn't have recommended it. And I'm very loyal. It was a very weird thing that I even made the jump. So I was doing print and radio at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the show was the Gianna Volpe Report. And it was like, going to its fifth year, and at that time the live stream of the show was now outperforming the actual airwaves. So it was getting, you know, it was getting at least 1,000 views by the end of the first day.
Right.
With nothing, and you know, I had an opportunity to take a job as a night security guard.
Mm.
And I was going to be able to pay off my student loans, basically. And I was like, can I say no to this for the, you know, $5,000 or whatever I was making in commission? And then, you know, no, I can't. For the first time, I was learning about because I had a job that I was loyal to cut me because of a business, like it was just the numbers.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was learning, oh, okay. Like these, you know, I have, if I want the house and the family and the this and the that, like I have to sort of make the right decisions and think think about the bottom line.
Right.
I had never thought about the bottom line, and I was just like busting my ass all the time, and I didn't stop, but I was at this point where I was like, okay, it was a moment of, can I say no to this money to keep this, you know, can I say no to this to keep this? Not really. Yeah. Can I take this, take the show off the air, keep it going on the live stream, pay my assistants, keep my advertisers, and add more? Yes, I can.
Right.
So I decided, I said, you know what? I'm going to do that. I'm going to tell Bruce tomorrow. I'm going to I'm not joking you. 5 minutes later, I got a call from Ed German at WPPB at the time saying Bonnie Grice is resigning and I want to recommend you for her spot.
That's amazing.
It was this total a moment of what just happened, you know?
Law of attraction, put it out in the universe thing.
Yeah, it was, and it was kind of like I always forget who the quote is by, but he said something like, the road you lead to avoid your destiny is the one that brings you to it.
Mm.
And it was another one is like, what is it, like God, the Godfather, where it's like, I tried to get out and they pulled me back in. Yeah.
It
was this thing where I had watched Bonnie and thought, and I had this like, I want to do that someday.
Yeah.
You know, like see myself do, but I took it. I made the jump, even though it was not like, it was scary because, and I was like, can I build my parachute on the way down? But it was because of knowing how important that spot was for the community and knowing myself as a journalist and thinking I will responsibly chair that position.
Right.
I will make sure that I am giving the platform to the people.
Right.
And I will make sure, because my biggest issue since I had gotten into the journalism game was that I was not seeing what I had learned at journalism school.
Right.
About what the ethics and the ideals of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'm going to do that.
Right. So who are the kind of people that you have? I noticed you seem like you have a lot of people who run charities and all people from the
The thing that I say is I play all decades and genres of music, and I speak to folks all walks of life all morning long on Long Island's only local NPR radio station, WLIW. And what is the total full circle moment of the whole journey so far in journalism is that just a few months after, or a year. So my year anniversary was March 26th.
Mm-hmm.
So I barely talked about my anniversary because it was like, you know, I've been on the air on the FM dial for a year and here's how many people died today.
Right.
You know, here's where we are and here's what we have coming to us in April.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really spend really any anniversary time, but what ended up happening was that was when the acquisition from WNET was coming through.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am, this Jersey girl on Long Island in this very uncool place to be from Jersey.
Right.
And now here's Channel 13.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out and becoming my boss.
Right.
And it was like the little reading rainbow you know, Mr. Rogers, you know, Muppet loving kid,
right?
Now is now, or you know, Sesame Street loving, right?
Sure.
Now they're my bosses, and I was just like, it was like this very beautiful poetic justice, and I absolutely love my show. I could not be more grateful for my platform. I could not be more pleased at the work I'm doing. It is, like I said, it has been challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't all been, you know, rainbows and ice cream sandwiches.
Yeah.
But nice. That's the job.
Yeah. My last question, I guess, do you ever see local journalism going away? It's kind of timely that I talked to you today about this, because just today, some lady put out a tweet, a woman named Liz Mayer, saying like one problem contributing to the demise of local media is the very minimal output of some local reporters. When you file like one story a week, it's hard to justify a high figure or low six figure salary, and you're not doing much to attract readers. There's too little content, you know. And she got crazy, like ratioed, and she deleted the tweet. But it got me thinking about that. Like does local journalism ever go away?
Yeah. What's her axe? I mean, like, what's her deal? Like, what is that? Who is she?
Yeah, I don't know. She's somebody who works for some sort of think tank, and she shills for like major corporations. She's more in the PR, you know, aspect. But you know.
Well, here's what else I learned from Mizzou is that, and here's I and their view was there will always be a spot for the local newspaper, and this was way back when in 2010,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we were talking about the move to digital news and how that was going to play out.
Right.
Anyone who's anyone, and that's like up to the suits, know the power of local news. So you talked about national news and whether or not it touches, which, you know, living on the East End and being in such close proximity, being 1% adjacent, as I sometimes say, you know, it's you get in touch with local, you know, and national news no matter what's going on. But that's also, journalism is about taking the national news and localizing it.
Right.
That's the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and yes, there will always be a place for local news.
So long
I
as
mean that.
Yeah, so long as there are local.
Go back.
People. Yeah.
So long as there are people.
Right.
Look at Facebook. Look at Twitter. Look at Instagram. What is it? It's people telling stories about what's going on around them.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I cut it off right there because we spent, I don't know, another 20 minutes or so just catching up on our lives, and that wasn't very particularly interesting for you. So that's it, folks. Stay tuned for next week's episode, and as always, you can catch these episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify, whichever you prefer. That's all. Everyone have a good week. Stay gold, everyone. Stay gold.